I've had a very nice week talking about different topics here. So it's a wonderful institution, and Lucien has given me the idea to approach some rich British philanthropists to see if we can convert one of our stately homes into a perimeter UK institute, which I think would be great. Well, I don't know whether or not people were at my talk, whenever it was, on Wednesday of last week. I know at least one person wasn't. But I want to continue to develop an idea which has arisen from trying to think about synergies between nonlinear dynamics and quantum foundations. So there's quite a recent paper on the archive, which is still in review for a journal, and I'm very happy to for people to email me if they have any thoughts, because I have to leave relatively soon after this talk's over, actually, to get my plane back to the UK. But feel free to email me if you feel you want to discuss anything. I thought I would just very briefly try to summarize what I said at the talk last week. And a lot of it was motivated by making a distinction between essentially the two only distance functions that exist in mathematics, in number theory, one being the familiar Euclidean distance function, which is the metric that we use to describe and analyze Euclidean geometries. But the other one, which I think is much less familiar in physics, but actually extremely commonplace in number theory, is the Piadic distance function. And the Piadic numbers and Piadic metrics are the sorts of mathematical tools need to analyze fractal geometries. So with Piadics, you can do Fourier analysis and group theory and calculus and all these things on Piadic spaces. Sorry, on fractal spaces. And since there's a wide class of nonlinear dynamical systems which have which exhibit this type of fractal geometry in their state space, the proposal I was trying to make is that one should actually use these Piadic metrics as metrics of choice when one's talking about distances between worlds or between states in state space or configuration space, whichever one is thinking about. So, you know, the baby there is just signifying the fact that our intuition is very much based on Euclidean distance of what we learn as kids. You know, two things are close when the Euclidean distance is small. But that intuition may be letting us down when we try to understand or try to address the question of whether two neighboring states in state space are close or not. And the main way the Piadic distance differs from a Euclidean distance is that it puts a premium on whether the points you're looking at, whose distance you're trying to measure, the distance between these two points, lies on some prior fractal set or not. And two points which are very close to each other in the Euclidean sense, but one lies on this fractal and the other doesn't, typically have large Piadic distance. From a slightly more physical point of view, so the whole notion of Piadic distances is consistent with thinking, as I say, about nonlinear dynamical systems. And the picture, the sort of big picture, I suppose, I want to frame is of the universe being a dynamical system itself, evolving in some way in its state space. So at the bottom there, I've got a cyclical universe, which I'm imagining, you know, which we draw in, you know, typically one draws in a sort of linear sense with time going, say, from left to right. But I want to think of that cosmology as somehow being packaged or wrapped up in some compact set in some state space so that so that neighboring trajectories in this compact set correspond potentially to, you know, times which in this linear sense would be very far apart. And there, as I said last time, there's quite a good analogy with DNA in our body. You would never understand life by taking the DNA out of a nucleus and stretching it out in a big long line and analyzing the genes and so on, chromosomes, linearly. The action, the way DNA replicates itself, depends crucially on how it is packed together in the nucleus, and the fact that two pieces of DNA, which are actually very far apart in this linear sense, become close together. So that's something which actually quite appeals to me, that there is a kind of biological analog of what I'm trying to propose at a much more cosmological level. One of the great things about p-adic numbers is that, well, by their nature, they lend themselves to some interesting number theoretic aspects, which, you know, normally in physics we don't really think about. And I tried to discuss the Bell theorem in the context of one of these number theoretic results. And the number theoretic result was that if you have, say, two angles whose cosines, so theta and phi, whose cosines can be described by a finite number of bits, then almost certainly the cosine of the relative angle between theta and phi can't be described by a finite number of bits. And that actually is a very simple application of the theory of Pythagorean triples, which goes back to Euclid. So in this talk, I want to spend a bit of time talking about the, rather than the Bell theorem, I just thought I'd talk a little bit about the application of these ideas to just quantum interferometry and the sort of Heisenberg uncertainty principle, if you like. And again, this idea about how, you know, we can get with these p-adics a kind of perspective or a linkage, a possible linkage to these very elementary ideas about number theory. The particular number theoretic result I want to use, so I'll just sort of just spend a minute talking about this, it again involves number theoretic aspects of the cosine function. So it's quite, I mean, cosines are very interesting from a number theoretic point of view, an interesting function. And the result is that if you have an angle theta where the cosine is describable, I've written by a finite number of bits. I mean, here actually one could just say a rational, if it's a rational number, then the angle itself is almost certainly not going to be a rational number. And I want to discuss the application of that to, as I say, quantum interferometry. So let me just outline a simple and elementary proof of that statement. So we'll assume that... I'm going to do this the other way around, actually. The theorem works in both directions. But so we'll do it the other way around. Let's assume theta as a multiple of 2 pi can be described by a rational number. Then the claim is that cosine theta won't be a rational number, except for 5 isolated exceptions, where cosine theta is 0, plus or minus a half, or plus or minus 1. So very, very, very small number amongst a set of all possible rationals of exceptions. So a simple proof of that goes like this. Assume otherwise, so assume that cosine theta is rational, and just for simplicity, well, just the way the maths works, it's easy actually to write, rather than write cosine as a over b, I'll write 2 times cosine theta equals a over b. So a and b are integers, b is non-zero, and we'll assume to have no common factors. Then we use a basic property of the cosine function, which is that 2 cos 2 theta equals 2 cos theta squared minus 2, to enable us to write 2 cosine 2 theta as this a squared minus 2b squared upon b squared. And you can easily show that if a and b have no common factors, then a squared minus 2b. So the numerator and denominator also have no common factors. So then what we do is we form a kind of a sequence where these thetas go up from cos theta, cos 2 theta, cos 4 theta, cos 8 theta, cos 16 theta, and so on. And look at the denominators in this sequence. And the denominators will go, well, 2 cos theta is b, and then 2 cos 2 theta will have a b squared, and then this one will have a b to the fourth, this will have a b to the eighth. So we've got this, the denominators have this increasing, if b is not equal to 1, so it must be 2 or 3 or 4 or something, or minus 2 or minus 3 or minus 4, then this will be, this sequence will just be growing without limit. So this means that if this is true, then there'll be an infinite number of values associated with the elements of this sequence. However, if theta over 2 pi, so we started by assuming theta itself was a rational, so theta over 2 pi is rational, then this sequence actually can at most have n possible values. So we have a contradiction. And that means that our assumption that b is not equal to 1 must be false. So b must be equal to plus or minus 1. And if b is equal to plus or minus 1, then a can only be 0 or 1, which gives us these 5 values. So this is a nice, very simple elementary proof that basically theta and cosine theta are, from this number theoretic point, very incommensurable. Okay. So we'll come to that in a very short time. Okay, so as I say, last time I talked about this idea of thinking of state space as some fractal set which locally has the structure of a Cantor set of trajectories, a bit like the Lorentz model. This Cantor set is something which I described as homeomorphic to the p-adic integers. Cantor sets, you know, one can define by taking some intersection of iterates. So in this, for CP, you have a unit interval and you throw away the middle bits, keeping P separate pieces. Typically P is 2 in the Cantor ternary set, but more generally you can think of P pieces. And then you subdivide those P pieces into P pieces and so on and so forth. You have a set of iterations. So the way it works is, if you think of a trajectory as one of these tiny pieces of this fractal, it means that when you zoom into it, you actually see structure. It's not just a line. It contains the higher order iterate. So at the kth iterate, you zoom in with a magnifying glass, and you see the k plus oneth iterate. And then I've got some kind of assumed instability in state space, which divides these trajectories, splits these trajectories up to discrete basins of attraction. And this, in my model, will be, if you like, the measurement process whereby trajectories are attracted to what we call measurement eigenstates. But in this picture, they would be discrete basins of attraction. And then one of these trajectories, again, you're now at the k plus oneth iterate, you zoom into that and you see yet more structure, and then maybe in the future that structure also gets split apart by some instability, and so on and so on and so on. It's a little bit like many worlds, the many worlds interpretation, except absolutely there is no branching. This is just an exponential instability, which is separating trajectories at this smaller, higher level of iteration out. So there's no branching as such. One's just looking at instability. So it's a bit reminiscent, but it's not many worlds. And just to say again, these trajectories are all cosmological space-times. They're this cyclical, this assumed cyclical universe, which has been wrapped into this fractal set. This is like, as I say, like the DNA packing, like the way DNA is packed into a cell. Now, one thing I didn't talk about last time, and this is kind of essential if we're to talk about interferometry, is how complex numbers appear in the picture. So I just want to give you a very simple picture of how complex numbers appear. And let me just start by imagining I've got a set with 4 bits. So they could be zero or ones, but here, oh yeah, I didn't say that. So the way I've colored, you can probably notice that in this diagram, I've colored these trajectories according to whether they separate into the left-hand basin of attraction or the right-hand basin of attraction. And here they're all nicely kind of intertwined with each other. Here at the kth iterate, all you see is a kind of a blur of red and blue, and then it separates out into discrete trajectories by this instability. So, So these bits are actually not so much, well, you can think of them as zeros and ones if you like, but I prefer to think of them as being labeled as, or as labels of these red or blue trajectories. So obviously what I'm thinking of in more generally is a case where I have 2 to the n, where n is some large number, but let's just stick with 2 to the 2 for the time being. And I'm going to define this operator, which obviously is written in a suggestive way, but define it in this following way, that it's kind of, it's a certain permutation on these 4 bits, but also with an additional, if you like, negation operator, which would take a red line to a blue line or a blue line to a red line. So this is a definition of this operator. Not, so it takes A1, A2, A3, A4 into not A4, A3, A1, A2. So why have I written it like this? Well, the answer is if I apply this operation twice, I get not A2, A1, not A4, A3. I'll leave that for you to do if you're interested. And then why do I call that this, e to the I pi over 2? Well, it's because if I do e to the I pi over 2 twice, so I do this again, I end up with not A1, not A2, not A3, not A4. So I've kind of gone back to this original sequence, but having negated all of the original bits to their negation. So this can be justifiably thought of as the negation of the string, the sequence, which gives it this symbol e to the I pi, which means that this thing is the square root of that, which means that this e to the I pi over 4 is the square root of that. So you can generalize all this to a if you like, arbitrarily long string, but still finite. And it allows me to define these operators, which basically have the same algebraic, multiplicative algebraic structure as the unit complex numbers. But with the restriction that phi over 2 pi has to be describable by n bits. So when n was 2, I can only get as far as pi over 4. But the bigger is n, the smaller these angles become. But they have to be describable this way. So then with this picture, so the idea is this is a string of trajectories, which describes one of the pieces, if you like, of this fractal. And I can link it to a Hilbert space vector, or Hilbert vector, just a simple one single qubit Hilbert vector. But with the following crucial restriction, you see this cosine theta over 2 is telling us what are the fraction of red trajectories compared to blue trajectories. So that requires cosine theta over 2, or cosine theta rather, I should say cosine squared theta over 2, in other words, cosine theta, to be a rational number. But by this construction of the complex numbers that I've just outlined, phi itself has to be, so the two parameters, theta and phi, in this Hilbert vector, with this correspondence to these trajectories in the invariant set, have to be constrained by these two constraints, that cosine theta must be rational and phi over pi must be rational. And this is where this number theoretic result comes in, because if we do a quantum interferometric experiment, if we know from quantum theory, if we start with a state, input state, and manipulate it with these unitary measurements, we know that the final state before measurement is of this form, where phi is now some sort of phase shift, phase angle. According to my theory, I can make the assumption that this Hilbert vector is describing some statistical ensemble of trajectories on my invariant set in state space, providing phi is a rational, cosine phi is a rational number. So let's assume that is the case, that cosine phi is a rational number. And now let's do a counterfactual type of experiment and ask what would have happened in a situation where I removed that second half-silvered mirror. All right, I'll just have that one. Yeah. So now we've taken that away. And we're sort of assuming that's the only thing we're just imagining a hypothetical world where everything is the same, but we've taken away that mirror. Now we know from quantum theory that the state is now described by this Hilbert vector. But if we have insisted in the real world, cosine phi is rational, then it means almost certainly from the theorem I've just described, this number theory theorem, that phi itself is not rational. And if phi is not rational, then this has no correspondence to this notion of an ensemble of trajectories on the invariant set. So there is no sequence of red lines and blue lines corresponding to that. We can turn the thing the other way around. If this was the real world, where now phi as a fraction of pi was rational, so that this did lie now on this invariant, this world, this was an experiment in a world which did lie on the invariant set, then the counterfactual, where we stuck the half-silver mirror back in, would mean that this cosine phi was now no longer rational, and then the counterfactual, where we had changed this into a ferrometric experiment, would no longer lie on the invariant set. Now, this might seem like kind of crazy fine-tuning, making a distinction between a number or an angle which is rational or irrational. You know, for a physicist, this sounds completely mad because, you know, certainly experimenters don't have any control when they set phase angles and such like. They have no control on whether, whether the angles they set are rational or irrational. All they have control over are some leading bits of the phase shifter. But what we're talking about here is not the difference between two experiments, you know, one that was done on a Monday and one that was done on a Tuesday. We're talking about two different experiments, one which was actually done in the real world and one which was, as it were, counterfactual, one that might have been done on the particular particle that was being measured but wasn't done. In other words, we're considering not so much as it were, moving along the trajectory of our space-time to some future time. We're looking at the structure of our theory in a direction transverse to these trajectories. And this is where I claim that assuming our intuition about Euclidean distance is correct, maybe misleading us. This is more what I talked about last time, but in the context of the Bell experiment, but exactly the same reasoning applies here for these types of interferometric experiments, except we're just dealing with a slightly different number theoretic property of the cosine function. So if U1 is a world or a universe where an interferometric experiment was performed in some Mach-Zehnder interferometer where the phi angle phi, well, is some phi, where cosine phi is rational. Then U2, which is the counterfactual universe, where we do a kind of which way experiment, if that's performed with exactly the same phi, then that won't lie on the invariant set. On the other hand, we can find some angle phi prime, which in the Euclidean sense, you know, is very close to this phi, but where phi prime is itself a rational angle. Okay, then that will be, and I'm going to call that U2 prime, that will be an allowable, that describes an experiment in a world which does lie on this invariant set. But now my claim is that even though it seems that we can make U2 prime as close as we like to U2, this would be our normal intuitive way of thinking, by making this phi prime closer and closer to phi, even though phi prime is rational and phi is irrational. From this p-adic perspective, so I'm not going to go through the maths of p-adic numbers again, but you can sort of look it up if you like. From this p-adic perspective, these are not close at all. Okay. So just to, you know, if we tossed a coin and it came up heads, and heads said we'll do this experiment, if we were to say counterfactually, if the coin had come up tails, then we would have done this experiment. This experiment wouldn't correspond to, in this theory at least, to an element of physical reality. The counterfactual world wouldn't be one corresponding to physical reality. And if we tossed the coin and it came up heads, and we did this experiment, and then we tossed the coin again and it came up tails, my claim is we wouldn't do this experiment, we would do this experiment. And because these are p-adically far apart, this is actually, ontologically speaking, an important distinction. So I don't know if you buy into this or not. I mean, it takes, you know, we can talk about it, and I'm happy to have email discussions. But my claim is that pretty much, and I've looked, these are the four things I've looked at carefully: Bell inequalities, this interferometry, sequential Stern-Gerlach apparatuses. You know, you get the same issue. Could you, if you take the second and third of a sequential Stern-Gerlach apparatus, could you counterfactually have reversed the order of the second and third? And then again, it's really from the property of, it's the same number theoretic property as Bell. That reversed experiment would take you off the invariant set. And then the same thing goes for the Pusey et al. Experiment, but there one has to consider counterfactually different preparations, which I won't talk about now, but it's in that paper on the archive if you want to see more about that. So one question you might ask is, where exactly does quantum theory itself fit into all of this? And I want to make a linkage to something which Michael Berry has written about as something quite pervasive in physics, in physical theory, and in particular in the development of physical theory, and that is the notion of a singular limit. And the claim.
I missed something completely basic.
Right.
You say it resolves it. What does it mean? Is there some contradiction that's going on?
Yes. So what I'm claiming is that this thing I'm calling invariant set theory is both realistic in the sense that Hilbert vectors, super Hilbert vectors which describe superpositions, can be considered to represent ensembles of of processes. So that the superposition is not ontologically special. And moreover, that this is a theory which is locally causal. So it resolves it in the sense of not requiring either a violation of realism or local causality. Technically, in terms of Bell, for example, it would violate measurement independence, but I would argue it does so in a natural way. That's something I described last time. Well, my point, so one last point. So my which I'm going to come to in a second, but my motivation for all this is to try to think about alternative ideas, let's say, to the standard ones about synthesizing general relativity and quantum mechanics. And my own view is that since relativity is obviously locally causal and realistic, geometric, maybe the way to find this synthesis is to develop a theory of quantum physics, which is more locally causal and geometric than is quantum theory. So in the sense, it resolves it in that sense, that it makes a theory which is more compatible with general relativity.
What are the alleged inconsistencies that are resolved? I mean, so I'm familiar with the first and last.
Well, I suppose why it is that. Okay, well, one way of looking at it is this question of can you describe the quantum interferometric experiment in terms of particles which, let's say, either go one way or the other? So this is not normally, you know, in quantum theory allowed. You have to kind of somehow consider a superposition. So in this perspective, you would be able to say that. And so the question then is, well, how does that, you know, normally the reason why you don't say that is because when you do a which-way experiment, you know, the interferometric pattern is destroyed. So in this picture, the reason you can think that way is because when you remove the second beam splitter in a counterfactual way, what that does is to take you off this invariant set. So that is the reason, if you like, why you don't get into a contradiction.
So somehow the key is to not allow you to imagine certain contradictions.
Exactly. That's right. And it's not any old counterfactuals. It's really, you know, this is what I find sort of interesting, that it's closely linked to these properties of this cosine function. It's very closely linked to number. It's sort of, you're guided by number theory. So I just want to say a few words about this issue about singular limits, because you can compute, I mean, when you have a fractal, the first thing anybody who works in fractals seems to do, you know, this goes back to the days when I think it was Mandelbrot raised the question, you know, what is the fractal dimension of the coastline of England? So you can do these things. Well, this is the standard fractal dimension. So as this p gets bigger, it tends to 1. So you might think as p goes to infinity, you kind of smoothly, as it were, get closer and closer to the real unit interval. But strictly speaking, this transition, if you like, from CP to the unit interval is not a smooth limit as p goes to infinity. It's really strictly a singular limit. Because for any finite value of p, no matter how big that value is, there will always be gaps in the interval. The measure, I mean, strictly speaking, the measure of CP on the real unit interval is 0 for all finite P. So although the fractal dimension sort of seems to be going uniformly to one, the measure jumps at p equals infinity. And basically what that's saying is that there'll always be the mapping between the fractal set and the unit interval is never a bijection. And similarly, this linkage to these complex Hilbert vectors is only really becomes this bijection at a kind of singular limit of p equals infinity. So this comes about, this notion of a singular limit comes about where you try to think about how all this might relate to dynamics. And I just want to just very briefly, and again, all this is in much more detail in the paper, just talk about, because this actually, this whole formalism lends itself quite nicely to the relativistic Schrodinger equation. Basically, because as I'll show in the next slide, you can very easily incorporate spinner type quantities into this. But the idea is if you imagine, now not just one set of 2 to the n trajectories, but 4 sets of them, and you evolve them in time with this exponential operator, which was defined as a permutation negation operator. I'm requiring here that omega delta t, again, is a rational number. Well, that only, for any finite value of n, this only steps things forward in a discrete way. If you want to get to the continuum limit, you have to again set n to infinity. And again, this becomes a very much a singular limit. But in this singular limit, you can think of these as the familiar complex exponential functions. And this structure gives you the Dirac equation just for a particle at rest. As I say, you can build in more structure if you want, because this permutation negation kind of trick doesn't only just give you basic complex numbers, it can also give you quaternion relationships. So if I define 3 operators on these 4 bits in this way, you can convince yourself that each 3 of them is itself, each operator is itself a complex root of minus 1, in the sense that applying the operator twice gives you the negation of S, but also that E1 or E2 then operated on with E1 gives you E3. So these are quaternionic triples. Again, all this is generalized very easily for 2 to the n elements, and you can link that to, you know, Dirac matrices and so on. So I want to slowly move towards general relativity, but before I do so, I just want to talk about the way I see the de Broglie relations working in this picture. And the idea is actually to think about general relativity, actually, and to think about the fact that in general relativity, the inertial properties of a particle, you know, moving on a geodesic, are really determined from the connection coefficients, and the connection coefficients feel out, as it were, the geometry of space-time neighboring that geodesic. And in a similar way, I like to think of the particles' sort of energy-momentum properties in this invariant set theory as being inherited from this neighboring geometry, but now on this invariant set. And because of these complex number constructions, there's some inherent periodicity in that geometry. So I mentioned very briefly the link, not exactly link, but there's a sort of partial, in some aspects of this splitting looks a bit like many worlds theory, but it's not splitting at all. Just want to make a brief suggestion here that there may be some, I mean, just think about the Newtonian potential, for example, in Newtonian gravity. I mean, Newtonian gravity was superseded by a geometric theory. So in some sense, the geometry of space-time has supplanted the Newtonian potential. I like to think of the, I'm not 100% sure about this, but it seems to me that the quantum potential in Bohmian theory could be thought of in a coarse-grained way, in a way that smooths out the fractal structure, this p-adic fractal structure in state space. Once you smooth out the fractal structure, once you've just created a potential function whose support is the whole of state space, then this resolution of the Bell inequality by local causality will then fail, because all counterfactual states, irrespective of where they are in state space, will be possible. So my view is that this is why Bohmian theory has to be explicitly non-local, because it's smoothed out. The L2 quantum potential is just a very sort of relatively crude, coarse-grained representation of what's actually a much more intricate, fine-scale geometry with gaps and so on in reality. So I just want to finish the talk with a few sort of, I have to say a bit more, well, you might think this is speculative anyway, but this will be even more speculative, but sort of where I'm sort of, in a way, what's motivated me to think about all this stuff. My background, original background, was in general relativity back in Oxford in the 1970s, so it's a kind of return to some of that stuff. So the question is, one has this feeling maybe the route to quantum gravity is to try to marry the Euclidean metric, pseudo-Riemannian metric, if you like, on space-time with this p-adic metric structure in state space. So the question is, how could one do that? Well, let's just write, this is just a trivial sort of way of writing, let's write the field equations of general relativity for our space-time m-naught as some integral over, let's imagine for the time being we don't worry about fractals or anything like that. This is just some state space which has a sort of regular, Lebesgue or something measure on it, where we can talk about some integral over neighboring space times in the space of space times. But I'm just going to stick a delta function here at m naught. So this is just identical to this because I got this delta function. And then I can always think of my delta function as some limit for this is p now, it's just any old number, if you like, such that when p goes to infinity, this distribution, which could be a Gaussian, or it could be some trigonometric function like this, when p goes to infinity, this collapses to the delta function. But now let's instead say, okay, this is not just a real number manifold. It's one of these p-adic manifolds. So this delta now is a function on this p-adic space. Mu is technically what's called a Ha measure. So you can do, as I mentioned, you can do the calculus. You can do calculus on p-adics. The relevant measure is called Ha measure. And now I'm going to let P be my prime number. But now let's, instead of going to this limit of P tends to infinity, which is a slightly awkward thing, probably not even mathematically particularly well posed when one's talking about p-adics, but instead just think of, just remove this altogether. So now I want to think about my generalization of general relativity like this. So this is some integral. This is some function with a support on neighborhoods of my p-adic space, where p is a large but finite prime number. So what would that do for you? Well, one thing you could think out is, one thing you could think about, which obviously you want a quantum gravity, theory of quantum gravity to do, is get rid of space-time singularities. Well, this is smearing out energy momentum. This is saying that our curvature, the Einstein curvature in our space-time, has contributions from this invariant set, from neighboring space-times on this invariant set, governed by whatever shape, whatever this is. Now, I don't know precisely what this function is at the moment, but one can say it's not a delta function. It's something which has some sort of finite support across the neighborhood of the invariant set. But at the very least, what this will do is act as a kind of an averaging kernel, which might well prevent you getting true singularities in the case of some collapsing star. But what is perhaps even more interesting is the notion that what this is doing is saying that the curvature in our space-time might well be being influenced by distributions of energy momentum, as I say, in these neighboring space-times. And maybe this is the sort of thing that we think of as dark matter. Now, this is totally speculative, and I haven't worked out any details here, but it's an intriguing idea that would mean that we might be wasting our time looking for particles in the LHC when this is really some geometric effect from the structure of the invariant set. And one can even go a bit further and say the fact that we have this generic instability, which is happening continuously as decoherence happens, maybe the gross effect of all this exponential instability, when one has this kernel taking you over the neighboring space-times, is to give rise to the possibility that this is a manifestation of what we call dark energy. I don't know. Just one point to make. I'm attracted by the idea that both Roger Penrose and Dioshi have sort of proposed over the years that quantum measurement outcomes may correspond to gravitationally distinct space-times. So in that picture, one would say that this sort of measure of the distance, the difference between these red and blue space-times, would have some sort of, would be quantifiable at some as being gravitationally distinct. Now, if that's the case, then these guys here, which you could perhaps link to sort of vacuum fluctuations in a field theoretic sense, would be absolutely minusculely tiny by this p-adic standard. They would scale as 1 over p in terms of their distance. And so maybe from this p-adic perspective, these vacuum fluctuations would actually not have any real gravitational signature in our space-time. They're just too close together. So this might potentially both give a mechanism for dark energy and also explain why this 10 to the 120 discrepancy between observation and quantum field theory might explain that result. So I want to just I've almost finished actually, but I just want to discuss one last point, because you know, in nonlinear dynamical systems, if a nonlinear system has a fractal attractor, then you need two things. You need regions where trajectories are diverging exponentially. That's the kind of instability that gives rise to chaos. But you also need regions of state space where trajectories are converging again. Otherwise, the trajectories would just diverge off to infinity. If you're going to keep this whole geometry in some compact set, there have to be regions of state space where trajectories are converging again. And the question arises, where would that be happening? Or where could that be happening in a cosmological, from a cosmological perspective? And here again, I'm attracted to ideas of Roger, probably it's because I did a lot of my work in Oxford, where Roger is a great presence, of course. And Roger has been a great promoter of the idea that, initially that black holes were, that there was real information loss in black holes. But more specifically, that black hole dynamics somehow involves what he calls a kind of collapse of the phase space. The phase space and state space are synonymous from my point of view. So he's imagining you have some, the universe is evolving, where a black hole is forming, and this necessarily causes a loss of some directions in state space. So the state space somehow becomes contracted. So here, after the black hole's formed, state space has somehow gone through this collapse process. I have to say, my own perspective on this is not quite the same as to imagine that state space, these dimensions have somehow been lost, but rather there's a compression or a convergence in these directions. So this is actually a compressed version. So the p-adic distance has gone down, for example, to 1 to 1 over p. And I think what this does, if my previous slide is right, what this does is take out the gravitational degrees of freedom. You may well keep the information, so I'm not necessarily proposing actually the information is lost, but it's so compressed that all the sort of gravitational degrees of freedom have been sort of wrung out of it. So the idea is that this would be happening sort of in the late phase of each cycle of the universe, which gives you the required compression so that the whole structure can stay within a compact subset in phase space or state space. All right, so thank you for being attentive and coming today. Just to conclude, my own belief is that this does provide a way to interpret the mysteries of quantum physics without giving up on local causality or realism. And I would claim without, by virtue of the use of this p-adic metric rather than Euclidean metric, without any apparent fine-tuning or conspiracy or any of these things which are normally associated with any kind of deterministic explanation of things like the Bell inequality. I'm aware that in the physics community, I mean, I'm encouraged by some of the sort of big names in theoretical physics worrying about entanglement. And there's been this ER equals EPR, this idea that entangled particles are somehow connected by black hole wormholes. I mean, I'm encouraged that people at least, you know, feel that, yes, indeed, we do need to explain entanglement. I just feel that wormholes seem awfully exotic to me. And you may well think that what I've been talking about is exotic, but it's really a very natural application of ideas in nonlinear dynamics. There's nothing particularly exotic in that sense. I'm just trying to say, imagine that the universe, just treat the universe as a dynamical system evolving precisely on some fractal invariant set in its state space. What properties would it have? And my claim is that it could well have properties that we would call quantum physics, but without any of the conceptual difficulties that we have normally associated with quantum theory. I mean, ultimately, I think I said this at the end, but I'll sort of repeat it. I mean, ultimately, what distinguishes this idea from other, let's say, hidden variable ideas is a sense in which actually we've kind of abandoned the what I call strictly reductionist approaches to fundamental physics. Because what we're saying is that this invariant set geometry, which has sort of arisen by thinking about the properties of the universe in the large, impose constraints on the physics of the very small. So that ultimately is the way I like to think about this, if it's correct, that the reason why this does what, say, standard hidden variable theories don't do is that we've got some kind of top-down, I'm using George Ellis's phrase now, top-down causation. The cosmological scale is imposing itself on the small scale, and that's why this seems to work. As I say, whether this is right or not, but it's relatively straightforward then, once one does this, to think about how GR might blend itself in. And there are some, whether this is right or not, but at least it provides some possible new perspectives on things like the dark universe, you know, how to get rid of space-time singularities. And as I say, this black hole information paradox, the idea not so much that you're losing information, but you're compressing it down to the scale where you've lost the gravitational degrees of freedom. So as I say, I'm sure a lot of it will be very controversial to people, and you may not agree with me, but I'd be very happy to engage with anyone who wants to, probably not now, because I have to catch a car to the airport in an hour, but feel free to email. Thank you.
This is probably something I just missed, but what determines the structure of the state space, and how important is it? In other words, there's lots of fractals, lots of ways to, is it a dynamical issue?
Well, when you say what determines it, I mean, let me just give you my, the way I sort of came to thinking about this, which is, as I say, to start by thinking about, you know, a large class of dynamical systems whose dynamics are actually are defined from differential equations, and then to say, well, what properties, what do those differential equations do if you integrate them out further and further into the future, like the Lorentz equations, and you find that asymptotically what they do is generate these fractal structures. So then what I did was to say, well, could we imagine just treating these differential equations as kind of scaffolding, as not being the primitive concept, rather than think about the primitive concept as being this fractal geometry. And as it were, throw away the differential equations. So then the question is, well, how would you go about defining fractal geometry if you didn't have the crutch of these differential equations? And that's where these p-adic numbers came in. It allows you to, at least in a, okay. So what it doesn't give me a picture of the global geometry, and I don't really have a clear picture of that, and I certainly can't give you a mathematical description of that. But what I can do is zoom in, you know, to a neighborhood, if you like, a state space, and say the structures that I'm interested in, or the structures that I will define to be the ones that I'm interested in, are ones where I essentially have a kind of Cantor set of trajectories, you know, so a real line, Cartesian product of the real line times a Cantor set, where this Cantor set, as I say, is has been generated from these p-adics. So that's...
Okay, the way I was thinking about it is the Cantor set is just one of many fractals.
That's right.
But is it...
That's why these p-adic integers, to be precise, the set of p-adic integers are defining this. So the p-adic integers, the main issue is that p-adic integers come with this metric. And what I'm doing is mapping the integers and the metric associated with it into a state space structure. And as I say, the key point about that is that when you have, if you have two numbers, one of which belongs to the set of p-adic integers and the other doesn't, then their distance apart will be typically large. And so this maps to a statement that a point on the Cantor set and a point not on the Cantor set, their distance apart is large, even though from a Euclidean perspective it may look small. So this is my way of kind of diffusing, if you like, these conspiratorial arguments about the Bell theorem. The reason why they look conspiratorial is because these worlds look so incredibly similar to each other, it's kind of ridiculous that they should have such large consequences. But they're not similar at all. The last talk I had a picture of, you know, this impossible triangle. This is a good example where, you know, if you look at it with a two-dimensional metric, it looks crazy, you know, the world looks non-local. But as soon as you zoom into a three-dimensional metric, you realize actually the triangle, at one of the vertices of the triangle, the two arms are actually not close at all. So you can understand it. And I'm claiming you can kind of understand things in a similar way by moving from the Euclidean to p-adic metric.
I have a technical question, but also I have a more conceptual one. Maybe I'll start with the conceptual one. I mean, you partly motivated this by saying that it could apply, maybe the reformulation of quantum theory that's suitable to mate with general relativity. But as far as I could tell, even in special relativity, right, there's no distinguished time. As far as I could tell, in this setup, you do have a kind of distinguished background time. It's not dynamical in the way time is dynamical in space-time, in relativistic space-time as we understand it. So I have two questions on that. One is, what's your time really continuous? That wasn't clear to me. I mean, you wrote R, but can this background time be compatible with relativistic space?
Actually, time, I think, isn't continuous. And I had that example of the sort of the Dirac equation, where I had these exponential sort of time operators. But it is discrete, so actually I'm actually not. It's not. I don't think it would be continuous. But it can be made as close to being continuous as you like by letting this parameter n be as large as you like. But it only becomes continuous in this singular limit. I haven't given much thought to be honest. I haven't given much thought to this question about preferred time or not. But I don't immediately. I'm not sure that I have particularly assumed anything preferred about time. Have I?
When you have a state, you describe the reality as a succession of states, maybe continuous sequence or discrete sequence, ultimately, but it's still a succession of states. So what would that correspond to? You know, what if we wanted to describe our world in that way?
I have parameterized.
Distinguished sizing of space-time, which would be very important in your description. I mean, only one slicing would be right, or else you need to incorporate some hidden diffeomorphism symmetry or proximate diffeomorphism symmetry, something that would allow the different slicing, you know, to be on the same footing.
I mean, I've used time, if you like, as a parameter to describe length along these trajectories. But I'm not sure that anything I've talked about assumes a particular parameterization. But maybe I need to think.
No, I'm not worrying about the value of the parameter.
Right.
But the fact that you, what does one particular state correspond? I mean, your reality is a succession of states. It doesn't matter if we use T or T cubed to parameterize it. But what does each one of these states correspond to in ordinary language? Approximate. You know. I was assuming it's something like a space like hypersurface. In the fields and so on, the data on that surface. Maybe that's not your intention. But then what is it?
Well, no, it is. Yeah, you're right. I mean, to take a state at a, you know, one of those a trajectory in state space at a point. I mean, that would correspond to because the line would be a space time.
Yeah. So then, don't you have a distinguished?
Well, I haven't. Okay. I'm not sure. I haven't given that much thought, so I can't tell.
So you have four A's parameters.
Yes.
Like the states.
Right.
And each A represents a different trajectory.
A trajectory, or to be more precise, it would be a particular one of the P pieces of the next iterate of the fractal. You could think of it as trajectories, but it would be one of the P pieces of the next iterate. Because that's the idea, is each, you know, you have these continuous, it's like, you know, a bit like, you know, when you look at the Mandelbrot set, you often see these pictures of, you zoom in and you see more and more structure, you know, indefinitely fine structure. And really, it's these successive instabilities are just zooming this structure past you.
So the sequence of A's are just more and more refined specifications?
Well, one particular sequence of A's are just a set of the P iterates at the next level of iteration. And then they get blown up, and then you can zoom into those, and each one of those has p more pieces, and then those get blown up some future time, and then you look into those.
So that string of four A's
should really be 2 to the n. I mean, I just use 4 as a.
But he's referring to a single individual state of affairs. At some point, I thought you said it was an ensemble.
It is an ensemble. Yeah. No. Sorry. You're to think of them as an ensemble of of possible worlds on the invariant set. Where, you know, could be 3/4 of them go to the right-hand basin of attraction, which you'd interpret as, you know, spin down in a Stern-Gerlach experiment, and 1/4 of them go to the left-hand basin of attraction, which would be spin up or something like that. So they would represent the sample space over which the probabilities which arise in the Hilbert vector, that's the sample space over which those probabilities are defined, which is why cosine squared theta over 2 has to be this rational number, because it's describing a fraction of the 2 to the n elements in the sample space. Can't be an irrational number, because it would be undefined if it was irrational. It has to be fraction of 2 to the n, which is why you're saying it has technically to be describable by finite n bits. But the n can be, in a way, as big as you like.
As a follow-up, I was confused on the same point that Lucien raised. If you take the full sequence of 2 to the n bits, or whatever it should be, is that the end of the story, or that it repeats? But I don't know if it should run out to infinity, or if it's a cycle, or whatever, but if you take the full sequence, whatever it should be, is that then like a single world, or is it still an ensemble of worlds?
The 2 to the n are 2 to the n different worlds, if you like. They're 2 to the n parts that correspond to one of the components of this Cantor set. It's it just comes from this wrapping of the trajectory, you know, round and round in itself on this compact set.
If I give you a concrete sequence like 0, 1, I don't know,
yeah.
Between 0 and p minus 1.
Right.
So I give you 0, 2, 5, 2, 2, 1.
Well, they also have to be zeros and ones, or red or blue. I mean, they're all red.
They should only be zeros and ones. So yeah. I give you 0, 1, 0, 0, 1, 1, 1. And I can fully specify that.
Right.
What have I described? Have I described an ensemble of points?
That's right.
Even if I give the sequence fully. So that still doesn't completely separate the points of your state space.
You've given me you've described, you know, every time you tell me zero, I say red. And every time you say one, I say blue. And these describe a set of 2 to the n trajectories, you know, in the neighborhood of my trajectory, that a certain fraction of which will be red and a certain fraction of which will be blue. That's the idea. So I was trying to just kind of think about probabilities in a very simple way. Can I just say this as a semi-technical point, that, you know, fractals allow you to define, this Ha measure allows you to define probabilities in ways in which, you know, Wallace, I know Mike, Wallace at Oxford, David Wallace, yeah, you know, got into great philosophical difficulties with. But fractals are just beautiful ways to describe probabilities without worrying about any of these problems. So you have a piece, it has 2 to the n pieces, that tells you a probability. You take one of those pieces and zoom into that, and it has 2 to the n pieces, that defines, you know, some.
But normally if you run that to infinity, then you've zoomed in completely, and you have a single point.
No, but you never do. I mean, that's the idea. You, in a fractal, you never zoom in as long as you want. It never runs out.
I don't understand, but the fractal has individual points. It's still some sort of a metric space. At least you say it is.
It's equivalent to, you know, a p-adic integer. A normal number. You have, like 3.14159... with p-adic integers, you have the numbers actually go off to the left. Right, if you write it in binary, and it stops here. And what this corresponds to is going deeper and deeper into the fractal. And the fact it never finishes just means that the fractal never finishes.
Right, but you could ideally to infinity the way you do there, go up to infinity to the right, here you can go up to infinity to the left.
Exactly.
Wouldn't that then be a single point of the fractal space?
Well, yes, but in the dynamical picture I have, it would take an infinite amount of time for you to zoom in, if you like, to that point. So, in any finitely evolving world that we live in, you'll never run out of structure.
Right. Okay, let's thank Julian.